Hello everyone. I am going to be talking about sternotomy versus minimally invasive surgeries. Now, there's a lot of material out there. There's a lot of interest in this right now. This is going to be a general overview looking at the benefits of avoiding a full sternotomy. Let's start in the beginning. Where did all of this minimally invasive stuff start? Well, it actually started quite a long time ago in the early to mid 18th century, where we had cystoscopes that were first introduced. First one that I could find any record of was with an army surgeon in Germany who developed what he called the light conductor in 1805. And what he did was he used some different manipulations with funnels and a candle and a mirror, trying to be able to visualize inside of nasal cavities and the urethra. Now, he had minimal success. He had a lot of problems with the flame injuring the patients, and he actually didn't progress too much with that. There were some animal trials done with this as well, but he kind of got the ball rolling with it. Then we're going to move along to the first functional endoscope was in 1826. Simultaneously, we had some things going on in Paris and in Boston. They're using a thin cylindrical tube that they put into the bladder, and they used a beam of light from a petroleum-filled lamp and mirrors for visualization. Now we're moving into, there were a lot of different experimentations moving up to this point, but here's where we really start getting started with the minimally invasive surgery. The first therapeutic application for an endoscope was done in Sweden and in Germany by Dr. Jacobus in 1912. He did a thoracoscopy to free lung adhesions from a pneumothorax treatment for a patient that had tuberculosis. Then moving into the mid-20th century, it was primarily used diagnostically. We had a lot of internists using it to diagnose some different things, and then kind of some advances were made in the 1940s and 50s by gynecologists who started using it for fertility assessments. Moving into modern times, there were a lot of challenges. Often these minimally invasives were difficult to perform. They had unusual patient positioning. One literature article I read described the doctor having to do acrobatics to be able to actually use the endoscopes to visualize what he was needing to look at. Cause longer surgery times because, of course, unfamiliar with these types of things, and they had lack of technical skills because it was a new technology. They were also limited by advancing for quite some time because of where we were with technology, with cameras and lights and all of those sorts of things. So they kind of got stuck for several decades. And many doctors also had a lot of skepticism in this area, thinking that it was just better to stick to the traditional means of surgery. Now, in the 1980s, there became a huge growth. We had huge advances in technology. We had digital cameras with video imaging. No longer did the surgeon have to hold a handheld camera and perform surgery at the same time, which you can imagine would be extremely limiting. They were able to perform more complex cases because they actually had use of both their hands. Okay, so you might be thinking, didn't hear anything about cardiac surgery in there. That's because they weren't interested or nobody had thought about performing it. I couldn't find anything about it. Really no interest until the 1990s. Then we have our first minimally invasive cardiac surgery. It was an AVR performed by Cosgrove and Sebeck in 1996 at Cleveland Clinic. They used a 10 centimeter parasternal incision, femoral cannulation. They determined that it was success and very beneficial. They described it as a simplified technique. It was much quicker opening and closing the chest, and they had good surgical exposure. just a little review here. So we on the far left-hand screen, that's of course the traditional sternotomy. It's 8 to 10 inches down the breastbone. Then we've got the right thoracotomy, mid-sternotomy, and that can be in the upper portion of the sternum or the lower portion of the sternum, depending on what kind of surgery is being performed. And we've got the thoracotomy, in this case would be a right thoracotomy, minimal incision, that's usually about 4 to 6 centimeters. And then all the way to the right, we've got ports where robotic surgery can be used to visualize for the surgeries. Talk a little bit about the benefits of minimally invasive versus a sternotomy. First off, something a patient is often very interested in is there's cosmetic benefits. It's smaller incisions, smaller scars, which of course leads to less pain. There's lower risk for infection because we're not having to go through the sternotomy. Lower risk for bleeding. There's less use for blood transfusions. They have a shorter hospital stay, which is always desirable to them. There's decreased financial burden from their length of stay and for their aftercare. Shorter recovery, it's 1 to 2 weeks for a minimally invasive versus a 6 to 8 weeks for normal activities. And we have some hospital benefits. Now you'll see a lot of these benefits overlap, but they're gonna be from different perspectives, of course. Overall, faster recovery, hospitals see that as a benefit as well. It's going to free up some of their beds, and that leads to less time for infections, lower readmission rates post-operative 1 year, which is highly beneficial. Then there's all the cost savings. There's reduced cardiac imaging, reduced laboratory tests, lower use of blood products, less time in the ICU, shorter hospital stay, and overall reduced staffing resources. Okay, so we've heard all these benefits. We're like, why isn't everybody doing it? Well, there's some challenges that have to be considered. Okay, first off, there's the surgical skill set. There's a steep learning curve. And sometimes it's not just being trained, it's the frequency of cases. How often are you gonna be able to have the patients that are good candidates for this? Are you going to have the available mentors to help you get your skill set up? There's also working in the smaller operative field. There's also a non-standardization of techniques. For the exact same procedure, many surgeons might have a different approach, might use different instruments, different types of cannulas, different ways that they're going to arrest the heart or not arrest the heart. There's often increased cross-clamp time and bypass time, especially in the beginning. Sometimes there's poor patient selection because you are trying to keep up the frequency of the cases and get the practice in so that you can become better. Then you can have poor results, and then there's decreased confidence in your patient population, in your hospital administration, and overall just in the surgical team that's performing it. There's a need for specialized equipment, which can be very expensive depending on, again, what standard techniques that your particular program is interested in doing. There could be just instruments. There could be cameras and audiovisual equipment that you want to install. There could be the need to develop a hybrid room. Maybe you already have a hybrid room, but it's being used by cardiology and vascular teams. So now that's you're going to have scheduling issues. And so forth. Okay, so our key points. What are we gonna do now? Well, we do know, according to the literature, that the morbidities and survival rate are the same. Many patients are becoming more educated about the surgeries that are being performed today, and so they're gonna start requesting this sort of thing. The cost-saving surgical option for hospital and patient is going to be desirable on both sides. And overall, it can provide a quicker recovery for these patients. These are my references. Thank you. And I thought we'd open it up to discussion. We've all had experience with minimally invasive surgeries, mm-hmm. especially in the last couple of years. And I wanted to talk about the experiences that you've had with them.
The case that we generally do minimally invasive are aortic valve replacements. We have two surgeons quite active in that. Drs. Matoria, who will be on our panel later on today, as well as Dr. Maniscalco. We've had very good results with these. From a perfusion standpoint, it's pretty much status quo as we do things. Obviously, since the surgeon is working in a much smaller area, the onus is on them to be able to gain the access and good visualization of the surgical field. It's normal cannulation with the respect of a fem-fem bypass situation. Mm-hmm. We use long venous cannulas to drain the SVC and IVC, and we use short cannula for femoral arterial access for inflow back to the patient. This provides pretty good visualization for the surgeon. And then as they make their small incision and they get all their instrumentation in, they use our specialized instruments for not only the extraction of the old valve, but placing the seating and putting in the new valve also. Mm-hmm. Standard cardioplegia tends to occur. Our guys like to use direct osteoperfusion of cardioplegia. That helps them along the way, and really it's a very nice procedure. Patients really appreciate the end result too with having a much smaller incision.
Mm-hmm. What do you think some of the challenges are that you've encountered?
One of the things is just to make sure, like you would do for any type of a fem-fem bypass, is making sure you get good return back, venous return back. That's always a bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. You will also notice most of these patients, we do hypothermia down to about 32 or 30 degrees, depending upon the surgeon. And what you see upon rewarming are some challenges toward draining the patient. Mm-hmm. But manipulation of the cannulas, good volume and good flows from the pump circuit tends to alleviate most of those. As we don't have a camera in our room to actually see when the heart gets, quote, overloaded by the surgeon, we depend upon them to say we're getting a little full or we need for you guys to increase on the vents a little bit more. But other than that, works out very, very well. Very mm-hmm. well.
I agree. That's the main challenge I think I've had as well, is just the venous drainage. Often because they have they're going femoral, they're going probably a little bit smaller than mm-hmm. maybe what we're used to for right. drainage. And so employing vacuum, I think, is absolutely necessary.
Absolutely. I agree. I think that seems to be probably the universal kind of challenge thing that you run into is just drainage, you know, flooding the surgical field. He already has a small surgical field to begin mm-hmm. with,
yeah.
And hopefully getting good arrest, so you're not having to stop, because those cases will absolutely end up being longer, probably cross clamp or pump timed versus your normal standard case, and depending on how intense the procedure is and what they're doing for straight AVR or MBR.
Well, and I think that too, depends on the experience of the surgeon.
Absolutely.
Of course, you know, the more often they're able to do these cases, the quicker they're going to get. I know in my previous employment, we did mitral valves and aortic valves very regularly.
Really?
Yes. But, you know, we had a surgeon that did these all the time. This was what he did every single day. And so it was very quick. And, you know, the more you get to do it, the more skilled you often become. But the number one complaint was always drainage.
Always drainage, yeah. It just stands to reason. These patients postoperatively tend to do a little bit better, more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to come out of their general anesthesia a little bit more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Recovery time
faster. Recovery
right.
time, yeah.
Recovery time.
I have read some, a lot of literature, and the average recovery time comparatively was 5 to 7 days versus 9 to 12 days. So
wow.
In the hospital, and that's a pretty incredible amount of time.
They also seem to have less postoperative pain because mm-hmm. the incision is smaller. It can be a little bit more localized. And they tend to pop off the vent a little bit more quickly, too, from what I'm noticing.
Yes. Usually within a couple hours is what they try to do. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? Discussion? No?
I don't know when we're going to be doing minimally invasive mitral valves, but that's going to be interesting to see that. I'm looking
yeah.
forward to that as the next step. And I'm sure that's coming. Our surgeons are very progressive, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we'll be doing those for 2 months longer.
Right.
Well, in my previous job, when I first graduated out of perfusion school, one of my jobs, we did robotic mitral valves.
Oh, yeah.
So those are very complex. They were 7:30 start cases, and we didn't finish till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But as he began to do more cases and got much more skilled and more familiar with approaches and how to do things, then we were probably able to finish maybe about 2:30, 3:30. Mm-hmm. So about an eight-hour case, 6 to 8 hour mm-hmm. cases. But, you know, you have a lot of other things that are involved. Depending, you know, nowadays, you know, a lot of doctors are using their needle, which is great because you give, right. you know, cardioplegia one time and then mm-hmm. you're good for the case. Versus when I did it back then, which was six, eight years ago, we were... You would redose, antegrade, and then you would have to give coronary sinus through the IJ, through a sinus catheter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you would have to have multiple pressures monitoring, because then when you give an antegrade, then you have the endo clamp, which they used to use for antegrade.
Right.
It might be called something else. I think it's called heart port now.
Yes,
but,
that's correct. Yeah, that's my first experience with those as well.
Same thing. It would migrate as you mm-hmm. give cardioplegia. Mm-hmm. So the pressures allow you to know where the cannula is, if it's in the right spot or whatnot.
And with that particular device, you have to have a lot of you have to have support from the anesthesia team, because there's separate training for that, because they're the ones who are putting that in.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a lot more challenges.
Those are very complex cases.
Yeah.
And speaking from an old scrub tech position, what I did many, many years ago before I got into perfusion, the instrumentation is all different too. The sternal retractors, which are not sternal at all, they're mini sternum, or they're specially made just for the thoracotic approach, and as well as the cross clamp, as well as all of the instrumentation for putting in the sutures, is completely different. So there's a little bit of a learning curve there for the surgeon too, to get used to all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see how they do it working in that tight space. It's really, really difficult, but they're getting really, really good at it. So, and they're a good diversion and a little bit different way of doing things than you've always done
right.
with the traditional mm-hmm. AVR with sternotomy.
Well, you know, you have all these companies now which are, you know, developing and innovating all the new technologies and different instrumentation for these minimally invasive procedures, from what, you know, you said started 96.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, compared to now, I mean, it's probably, you know, cut times and, you know, techniques and enhance all the capabilities that, you know, what they didn't
have.
Well,
I think the overall opinion within the medical community has changed as well. They see that this is the way things are going, that mm-hmm. this isn't just, you know, some...
cosmetic.
Yeah,
or
right, exactly. That this is actually benefiting the patients as well as, you know, the overall mm-hmm. Hospital environment.
Could either of you, since you've had a little bit more experience with this in your past than I have, can you speak to the situation when you're doing a redo sternotomy and the choice is to go with a minimally invasive approach? Do you see that is able to be done? And if so, do you see that there's less time and less you know, possible deleterious effects from mm-hmm. reopening the sternum again? Can you gain access to that? Through the thoracotic approach.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to see that?
I actually don't recall a case like that. What about you?
Yeah, I can't either. I would imagine a redo case like that could be problematic getting in and having good visual, because you just don't know what kind of adhesions you would see under the chest wall.
Right.
Even
yeah.
trying to make a small incision,
right.
you know, 4 to 6 centimeters, and being able to see and actually perform the procedure, I mean, it could probably be done, but I hadn't had the experience to
Yeah,
have
I don't think we've done a
redo sternotomy
yet approach,
for
so
minimally.
Maybe
basically.
We'll talk to Dr. Matoria when he gets
yeah.
here about
mm.
what
maybe
the challenges he may face on that.
Right.
Right.
That's excellent. Okay.
All right.
Excellent.